effects with my mouth.
Okay, but it better be good. Here we go. How well I remember when I was a barefoot boy. 'Twas April, and all of San Pedro seemed to mirror the tender loveliness of spring. Beautiful spring.
Squeak, squeak, squeak.
What's that?
The spring squeak.
How I love to go to the barn and milk my favorite cow, old Bess.
Moo, moo, squirt, squirt. And a nickel back in the bottle.
Then came the wanderlust, a mad yearning for travel. And I saddled my horse and rode away.
1, 2, 3, clump. 1, 2, 3, clump. 1, 2, 3, clump.
Hey, wait a minute. What kind of a horse is that?
He's got a wooden leg.
How the noise of the big city thrilled my ear. Yeah. The big city thrilled my ear. Anyway, how the noise of the big city thrilled my ear. I say the noise of the big city thrilled my ear.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
You're working on it? Ray, my little pixie, there comes a time in a man's life when everything looks dark. He loses a job. He gets sick, and there seems to be no relief.
No what?
No relief. Relief. You know what relief is?
Yes.
Well, from now on, you're working on it.
Now that the kids are back in school, football is in the headlines, and there's a keen nip in the morning air, I bet you've all begun to realize that fall is really here. Well, fall is a grand time to brighten up the family's breakfast with something everybody will enjoy. A brimming bowl full of swell-tasting Post Toasties. These appetizing oven-toasted cornflakes are delightfully crisp. Their wonderful flavor is just downright delicious. And say, Post Toasties are packed with food energy to help you start these glorious fall days right. And don't forget, most grocers are selling Post Toasties today at a price below that of any other nationally advertised cornflakes. So tomorrow, ask your grocer for Post Toasties, the wake-up food. Sosnick and the Post Toasties Orchestra present one of the many grand tunes from The Wizard of Oz. It's Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead.
Old witch,
the wicked old witch.
Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead. Wake up, you sleepy head. Rub your eyes
and get out of bed.
Wake up, the wicked witch is dead. She's gone where the goblins go. Below, below, below.
Ho-ho!
Let's open up the gates and sing. Ring the bells of ding dong, the merry old. Swing it high, swing it low. Let them know the wicked old witch is dead.
Tonight, folks, we are going to be
Well, well, greetings, chum. I understand you're going to New York for the premiere of your picture, $1,000 to touchdown.
Yes, sir, and the World Series, of course.
Oh, of course.
Have you and Demling decided to come along, I'm afraid?
No, no, Joe. You see, we're merely looking out for your welfare.
That's it.
We bought your tickets for you. Here they are.
Well, thanks.
Great, they are.
That's very nice of you.
Oh,
hey, wait a minute.
Huh?
These tickets are only good from the Union Depot to the Los Angeles city limits.
Oh, well, think nothing of it, chum. Once you get to the Los Angeles city limits, you can walk to New York in an hour.
You know, on second thought, Joe, I don't think you should go to New York at all.
No. Why?
Oh, well, think of all the confidence men they have there. And think of all the beautiful girls.
I am.
Oh, but those beautiful girls are liable to turn your head.
Do they really have lots of beautiful girls there?
Well, certainly. In New York, beautiful girls are a drug on the market.
Yeah? Take a look at a dope fiend.
Well, Joe, to convince you that New York is not the place for you, we're going to show you actual pictures of the pitfalls that beset a young man in a great city, Joseph.
Absolutely. Now, Joe, if you'll just go down there and take a seat in the audience, we'll show you the most soul-stirring drama ever seen by human eye.
Well, okay, I'll sit down there in the first row, but this better be good or you'll hear from me.
Just make yourself comfortable. Okay. Everything will be under control. Maestro. See, that's pretty. Picture number one. We find the young and tender husband leaving his dear wife to seek his fortune in the city. It's early morning and he's through packing. His wife is just closing the bags under his eyes. A little earlier that morning, she just closed one of his eyes. Next picture, please. And now we find the young man huddled in his seat on a train.
Suddenly, the train lurches.
Yes.
Two girls lose their balance. They fall in his lap.
Yes.
Horrors. What shall our poor young man do?
Ah, but he is the soul of honor. He looks at the two young ladies on his lap and says sternly, "Look here. One of you dames will have to get off." Picture number three.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Frank. My wife found that picture on me and made me burn it.
Okay.
Picture number four.
Ah, yes. Here is our young man of the pure heart in the city now. And does he go to a wretched burlesque show? No, he is in church. He doesn't have any extra buttons, so he puts a zipper in the collection box. Picture five, please.
He walks and walks.
Yes.
He has no job.
No job.
He sits on the steps of the public library counting pigeons when he is accosted by a city slicker. The slicker tells him it would cost a dollar for every pigeon he counted.
And then?
He gives the slicker $14.
Gad, what a swindle.
It sure was. He'd already counted over 50 pigeons.
Get off. Sorry. You seem to be a pleasant moron, Willie. I think I could have a lot of fun ignoring you.
Sorry, Chum. That was my mistake.
Social?
Of course. My apologies.
Accept it.
Thank you.
Not at all. Do you mind if I rub a little snow on your bald spot? I want to make a ski jump for a grasshopper.
Yeah. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Next picture.
Back in his room, our hero pens a cheery note to the little woman. Dearest, he says, and I quote, New York is amazing. Today I visited the Brooklyn Bridge and saw the spot where a man shoved his wife into the river. Wish you were here. Next picture, please.
He meets a woman.
Oh.
Ah, now we have it.
Yes.
A city racket. She intends to bewitch him, insure him, kill and collect. She promises him a cherry phosphate if he will but kiss her. But what shall he do?
Her siren gaze fastens upon him and then... I can't go on with it.
Oh, buck up. Dogged does it, old chap.
Rather. Muddle through, old chap.
Rather. Gentleman's code, old chap.
Rather. Honor of the regiment, old chap.
Quite.
Quite.
Quote.
Unquote.
Quite.
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 Fire!
What's the matter, Joe? For
no
heaven.
It won't do at all.
It won't?
Absolutely no good.
Oh,
now, but look,
whiz.
Joe, we just wanted to show you what terrible deception there is in a big city.
Certainly.
You should stay in Hollywood.
Absolutely, Joe, where the deception is shocking in New York. Now, for instance, there's nothing Dutch about the Holland Tunnel. Columbus was never within miles of Columbus Circle. And Times Square happens to be a triangle.
Yeah, well, we've got about the same thing here.
What do you mean?
After all, the Brown Derby isn't a hat. There aren't any hills in Beverly Hills, and you can't eat post toasties out of a Hollywood bowl. Me for New York. Now scram.
So long,
so long, so long. Ah, I'm glad that I'm rid of those crackpots.
Toasty!
Oh, it's Blanche. Hello, Blanche.
Gee, I want to congratulate you on your picture preview. Look, the New York Times has your kisses spread all over the front page.
My picture?
Uh-huh.
Oh, let's see it. That's swell. Oh, Blanche, that's not my face. That's a picture of the Holland Tunnel. All I get from you is insults.
Well, you don't have to worry about me much longer. I'm going on a vacation. I'm going to New York myself. You think I can get around in that dangerous traffic?
You're from Los Angeles and you ask that?
I guess all a pedestrian has got to do is just be calm and collected.
Well, I don't know. A friend of mine went through traffic yesterday. He was calm, and he's still being collected. Are you driving to New York, Blanche?
Yeah, I'm going with my brother and his wife.
Oh, I didn't know your brother was married.
Well, he ain't been married long. He was a bachelor the best part of his life.
Sister, no matter when a man marries, he's a bachelor the best part of his life.
Oh, you men think you've been taking a beating ever since it all began, don't you? Just because poor Adam had no one to take his part.
Oh, it wasn't so bad for Adam. After all, Eve came out on his side.
wrongly? Well, but just the same, are the three of you, just the three of you going, you, your wife, and his brother?
What?
You, your brother, and his wife?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, my brother and his wife. His folks are going, too. You know, his outlaws.
You mean his in-laws?
Well, what's the difference?
I see what you mean. But outlaws are different from in-laws, Blanche. An outlaw will take what you've got just once and then quit.
Working with Joe at Paramount in his new picture, $1,000 a Touchdown, I had the opportunity, of course, to chat with Martha Ray, who co-stars in the picture with our Joe. During the conversation, Martha said, "You know, Don, a busy day ahead is my cue for post-toasties at breakfast. They're my wake-up food because they help me start the day right. And post-toasties are my favorite cornflakes because they're so crisp and good to eat." Well, I told Martha Ray that people just about everywhere agree with her. And if you have post-toasties for breakfast tomorrow, you'll see what I mean. Because post-toasties are made of choice sun-ripened corn. Every crisply toasted cornflake is rich in food energy and partially dextrinized for easy, complete digestion. Post-toasties are light, not heavy, yet cram full of food energy to set you up for the morning. No wonder post-toasties are called the wake-up food. So have some for breakfast tomorrow. Post-toasties, the wake-up food. Charming post-toasty songstress Margaret McRae sings, "Are You Having Any Fun?"
Are you having any fun? What you getting out of living? What good is what you've got if you're not having any fun? Are you having any laugh? Are you getting any loving? If other people do so, can you have a little fun? After the honey's in the comb, little bees go out and play. And the old gray mare down home has gotta have hay. Are you having any fun? Or you'll never live forever. But before you're old and gray and still okay, have your little fun, son. Have your little fun. Hey, fella with a million smackers and nervous indigestion. Rich fella eating milk and crackers. I'll ask you one question. You silly so-and-so, with all your dough, are you having any fun? And what you getting out of living? What good is what you've got if you're not having any fun? Better have a little fun, 'cause you'll never live forever. But before you're old and gray and still okay, have your little fun, son. You better have a little fun.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and I repeat, our little theater off the Alcatraz rock pile presents a stirring newspaper drama entitled Bugtown. I will portray the character of Onyx, intrepid colored reporter, and will be supported by Gillen Demling of the Pismo Beach Kitty Review and an all-star cast players direct from the Winter Garden Sky Room Theater, East Yonkers. The scene opens in the editorial room of the Bugtown News. Riley, send Frank Gill in here at once.
Yes, he's right outside. Oh, Mr. Gill?
Yeah.
I've got a big job for you, Gill.
Yeah?
Where is your assistant?
Well, I fired him. He disgraced us.
I sent him to report the big football game and told him to sit on the coach's bench.
Well?
He thought I said wench.
Well, I just got word that the police have surrounded Killer Spumoni.
Too late.
The police have surrounded Killer Spumoni in the deserted shack in the country.
Yeah?
I want you to get out there and report the job.
Okay, but I'll have to have an assistant.
All right. Riley, yeah? Send in that applicant who's been waiting.
Come in, please. Yes, sir. Here he is. Fit as a fiddle and bow-legged as a piano. Onyx California Driver Brown.
Onyx California Driver Brown?
Yeah.
Well, how did you ever get California Driver in your name?
Well, sir, on account of when I was born, my father took one look at me and didn't know which way to turn.
So you want a newspaper job, huh?
Yeah.
Well, tell me, what kind of work have you been doing?
Well, sir, up until recent, I was manager of a laundry.
Oh, really? And what made you give up managing a laundry?
Well, see, she divorced me. Yeah, of course, in a way, the mutual divorce was mutual.
Well, that sounds highly interesting. Proceed.
Well, up until the time the union got strong, my wife used to kiss me every day.
She did?
Yeah, but when the union came in, she cut me down to 3 days and put on another man.
Well, all right, Gil, get going. This is an important case. Spumoni's one of the biggest crooks in the country, and he's wanted in Los Angeles.
Oh, really? I didn't know they needed any more crooks in Los Angeles. Well, come on, Onyx. Let's go.
Yeah, here we go, boy. Hey, boss.
Yeah?
Boy, you was going powerful fast, ain't you?
Yeah, I know, but keep your eye peeled for speed cops, Onyx. I don't want a cop to pass me and flag me down.
Yeah, you don't have to worry none about passing in his car. Nobody's gonna do that.
No?
No, sir, I done fix it.
Oh, you did? Well, how did you manage it?
Well, sir, I just put a sign on the back end which says, pass at your own risk. Wife driving. That'll stop him, boss.
Yeah, that'll stop him.
Hey, but... boss.
Yeah.
Boss, is this man a very tough man, this one we're going after, this Spumoni?
I'll tell you, Onyx, he's the toughest man in the country.
Yeah? Man, he ought to tangle with my ex-wife.
Your ex-wife? Was she tough?
Tough? Yeah. Boss, she was so tough that a cyclone had to get a permit before it could go through the house. Woo! Yes, sir. She was really belligerent.
Yeah, that sounds pretty tough.
Yeah, well, it looks like we is out in the country at last.
Yeah, but how can you tell?
Well, we ain't hitting so many pedestrians.
Onyx, quiet.
Yeah.
There it is. There's the shack now. It looks like we got here before the cops.
Mm, so what?
So what? Well, just think. We might be able to capture Spumoni ourselves.
So what?
You might even do it without getting shot.
So what?
So I'll stay out here and you go inside.
So long.
Now, wait a minute, Onyx. Wait a minute.
What?
You're not afraid, are you?
Afraid?
Yeah.
Well, no, they're not exactly, but I wish I had on Don Wilson's pants.
Well, why?
Because there's more room to shake in. Wow.
Onyx, I'm ashamed of you. How would you like to hear people say what a coward's life he lived?
Well, that's much better than not being able to hear the preacher say how brave he died.
Listen, I've had enough of this. Onyx? Get in there.
Get in? You mean go on in?
You go right in and right now.
Okay, boss, but it's a half-hearted gesture.
Go ahead.
Here goes nothing. All right. Come on in, golden boy. No, thanks. I think I'd just as soon stay on the house.
Come in!
I'll then.
Now stick him up.
You mean he wants me to put up my hands?
Stick him up!
Day's up. Yeah, say, would you all mind taking that big gat out of my ribs?
Brother, you ain't seen my gat. I use this little thing on small fry like you. Why, this little thing ain't nothing but a baby gat.
Yeah, well, maybe so, but I've seen plenty of gats. But that ain't no gittin'.
Now, just a minute, Eight Ball.
Eight Ball?
You must have a little cash on you. Hand it over.
Well, all I got here is 80 cents. Guess I don't get me no dinner now.
Well, I guess that's pretty cheap, holding you up for 80 cents.
Yeah.
I'll only keep half.
Yeah.
Here's 40 cents back. Remorse is gnawing at me conscience.
Is that so? Well, okay, thanks, boss. And when it starts gnawing again, you can send me the balance. Now, if you don't mind, you can point that cannon in some direction in which I ain't.
Oh, scared, huh?
Yeah, no.
I didn't think any man would have the nerve to come after Killer Spumoni single-handed.
Oh, I ain't exactly scared, boss. My nerves is as calm and smooth as a soft, sweet waltz.
Yeah?
But my knees are definitely rumba. Boy, maybe you won't mind if I sort of regains my discomposure by smoking on one of my quota cigars.
Quota cigars? What you giving me? You mean you pay 2 bits for that rope?
No. My boss, he smokes 3 quarters and then I smokes 1/4.
Well, okay, go ahead and smoke. But it's gonna take more than that to calm you down when I get through with yous.
Buddy, you ain't gonna scare me no more than I have been scared.
Yeah?
Once I was calling on a hen house and the farmer caught me. Oh, boy, was I scared.
What makes you think that's the most you could be scared?
Well, I must have been scared, because when that farmer grabbed me by the arm, he looked me right smack dab in the face and he said, "What are you doing here, white boy?"
Waiting for Joe and Jill, let me remind you that Post Toasties are tops in taste among corn cereals. Crisp, refreshing, delicious, famous for flavor. Another thing, Post Toasties are light, not heavy, yet rich in food energy to help you through crowded morning hours. And Post Toasties are economical, because most grocers sell them today for less than any other nationally advertised corn flakes. So try Post Toasties. See if you don't agree that for flavor, food energy, and low price, there's no better breakfast cereal anywhere than Post Toasties. Tomorrow, ask your grocer for the big economical yellow and red box of Post Toasties, the wake-up food. Now for the boy Joe and his sweetheart, Jill.
Joey, dear, how could you be so natural in that underworld play tonight without knowing anything about gangsters?
Ah, that's easy. I had a job one summer as a cashier in a police station.
Well, a cashier in a police station?
Yeah.
Well, what did you do?
I counted the coppers as they came in. You know, Jeff, the character Spumoni in the play tonight was based on a real-life character. He was a tough one, all right.
Well, was he really as crooked as he seemed in the story?
Crooked? Spumoni was so crooked he had to screw his socks on. They finally got him and sent him to the penitentiary.
Well, Joey, did Spumoni ever get out?
Oh, yeah. He was sentenced to 10 years, but he got out in 9.
Oh, how could he ever do that?
Made up a year in summer school.
You know, Joey.
What?
I don't care anything about gangsters or policemen or public enemies. You're the only one that matters to me because I love you.
Better than bubblegum?
Better than bubblegum. You're the public sweetheart number one that's a prisoner of love forever in the solitary confinement of my heart.
Gosh.
Joey, dear, you know something?
Mm-hmm. What?
Well, I was passing a store window today and I saw something that I hope you'll buy for me someday.
What was it, Jill?
Well, it's something that makes every woman's hand look just a little bit lovelier. Something that makes a woman feel closer to the man she loves. When I'm washing dishes, it won't seem like a task at all, because I can look down and see your lovely gift.
Yeah?
Yeah. Even when I'm washing your shirts and socks, I won't mind, because I can look at my hand and see the thing that made it possible for me to wash your socks and your shirt. It'll be a lovely gift, Joey.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean, don't you, Joey?
Yeah.
What?
Rubber gloves.
A few words with my pals. Listen, boys and girls.
Every once in a while, children are tempted to dash off to school without enough breakfast. I hope you don't. Eat a good breakfast and be sure to have a bowl of Post Toasties. Those delicious cornflakes are chock full of food energy to help you through the morning. And, of course, every Post Toasties box has those swell Walt Disney cutouts. Now, here's another thing. After you get to school, work at your studies and work hard. That's the only way you'll ever amount to anything. Don't expect to get anywhere sitting around waiting for someone else to do the work for you. Remember, as old Chinese philosopher once say, only thing that ever comes to him who waits is whiskers. Night.
Daylight saving time adds Sunday, September 24th. If your community has been on standard time right along, this program will reach you 1 hour later. Otherwise, tune in next week as usual. This is Don Wilson saying goodnight for the makers of Post Toasties, the wake-up food. Heard on tonight's program was Are You Having Any Fun? From George White Scandal. The Joey Brown program came to you from Hollywood. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
7 p.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time, courtesy of the Bulova Watch Company, 5th Avenue, New York. Attention, please. Garfield Hospital has requested us to contact type 3 blood donors. Will type 3 blood donors please get in touch with Garfield Hospital immediately? Thank you. WJSB, Washington.
You're listening to The Santiago Boys, the amazing story of a democratic tech utopia that could have been. I'm your host, Evgeny Morozov. In our previous episode, we learned how cybersyn was increasingly under attack and from many sides at once. From leftists who distrusted it, from journalists who ridiculed it, and even from engineers who misinterpreted it. And we saw how its makers struggled to persuade Allende's government to adopt the system, with Allende himself feeling increasingly isolated. Coming up on this episode, even more drama and intrigue. Stafford almost abandoned cybersyn, going on a spiritual quest as a hippie rebel. Fernando Flores, in turn, is threatened by someone who wants to take over the project. And we'll also hear about the last meeting between Allende and Stafford, the meeting before everything would change forever. Stay with us. They had a vision of a new kind of socialism powered by computers, the Santiago Boys. But things are falling apart in their Chile. The economy is crashing, the streets are dangerous, and those milk spoons, well, they aren't helping it either. Milk itself is harder and harder to come by, especially when people are eating the cows instead of milking them. And then something happens that chokes everyone. The biggest copper miner in the country goes on strike. The mine that belongs to the government. The mine that Allende needs in order to fund his revolution. It's a disaster waiting to happen.
El Teniente is a mine, a very strong mine that is a little bit to the south of Santiago.
This is Sergio Bitar, then Allende's Minister of Mining.
The problem there was that one leader of the Socialist Party among the workers led the strike against Allende.
This is what Allende's revolution has come to. Members of his own party are now striking against him. And the workers are joining them too. The opposition sees an opportunity and wants to take advantage. A nationwide protest is already in the works, with hopes of repeating the transportation strike. And now the miners are even marching on Santiago, ready to make their voices heard. Now, a few weeks later, as they come to compromise with Allende and return to work, it seems like the conflict might finally be resolved. But just as things start to calm down, the situation takes a turn for the worse. Reports of attacks and intimidation against the miners begin to flood in. Meanwhile, the technicians of those mines continue their protest, and the battle for production grinds to a halt. The usual split between workers and experts rears its ugly head again. It seems that Allende just can't get both of them on his side at once. Sergio Bitar, with his Harvard education and his highbrow credentials, finds himself struggling to tame this chaos.
There was no vision of a process of rhythm.
And if things weren't bad enough, the opposition votes him out of office. With the country in turmoil, can Allende muster the strength to fight back? And how many will follow him? Amidst growing violence, the Santiago Boys are confronted with a brutal reality. Their Telex networks are no match for the terrorist networks of their enemies. And many of those enemies come from Patria y Libertad. As usual, they are planting bombs and sabotaging crucial infrastructures. And many of their tactics are very similar to those that the CIA used in Cuba in the early 1960s, in that notorious Operation Mongoose. Gabriel Rodriguez recalls the intense psychological toll of constant terror.
This has never, never happened in this country. One thing is putting Miguelitos on the road in order for the trucks to get stopped. But something different, and when you have these bombs exploding in different places.
The tension in Chile's political arena mounts with each passing day. The government coalition struggling to maintain its unity against violent attacks. The conflicting viewpoints of Salvador Allende and his daughter Beatriz reflect this growing schism within popular unity. Tanya Harmer explains.
The differences between Beatrice and her father are really, really boil down to differences over how they might begin to prepare most effectively to meet a potential coup d'etat against the government.
We are back to the long-running debate about people's power versus technocrats' power.
these divisions are on the one hand between those who believe that in order to prepare for a coup, the best thing is to mobilize supporters, to prepare militarily, to covertly start stockpiling weapons, and to really move forward without kind of negotiation or hesitancy. That's really Beatrice's side.
But Allende takes a different tack. He opts for negotiation with the opposition and, of course, the military. He still thinks that they will eventually respect the constitution and that his way of doing things, the peaceful one, will be able to prevail. Project Cybersyn is not immune to all this turmoil. There are now competing visions of what exactly cybernetic software is supposed to do. Stafford Beer thinks it's a tool for the people. Others on the team take a more limited view, seeing it as nothing but an experimental tool for managing the economy. And a prototype, really. And a technocratic one at that. That conflict of a vision and strategy could tear Cybersyn apart. How will they resolve it? And will they? As Chilean leftists cannot seemingly agree on anything, their far-right opponents are ramping up their terror. A Chilean graffiti bearing the menacing logo of Patria y Libertad gets scrawled across the walls of President Allende's own residence. It's a stark reminder that no one is beyond their reach. Not even the president. Carlos Sena, the latest Brazilian addition to the Cybersyn team, is already bracing for the worst. It's almost like he's reliving the prelude to the 1964 coup back in his native Brazil. A coup that set the stage for brutal torture by the new military regime and, of course, for his own exile.
INTEC, the Instituto de Investigaciones Tecnológicas, was threatened by the Patria Libertad, the right-wing armed group of the right. And so I was invited to join the technicians who would defend the Instituto, who would keep armed guards during the night.
Carlos may have lived through one coup already, but it's obvious that no training or experience could match the lethal weaponry of groups like Patria y Libertad. The Santiago boys find themselves woefully outgunned.
They had machine guns and they had bombs. And I was given a hunting rifle with some cartridges. How could I, with a hunting rifle to kill birds, with a few cartridges, face fascists with bombs and machine guns? It was completely nonsense, rubbish.
Carlos and his friends might not have the most formidable arsenal, but they do have one secret weapon.
The girls, the institutes, they helped us providing some empanadas, delicious empanadas.
And yet, they opt for cocktails of Allende's red wine. But cocktails of a very special kind.
They did Molotov cocktails, they had the bottles, they have the elements, everything. So they provided Molotov cocktails, and he kept guards with hunting rifles.
But can these nerds truly go toe-to-toe with Molotov cocktail veterans like Mike Townley of Patria Libertad? After all, he's still the unchallenged cocktail kingpin of Santiago. As Cybersyn gets mired in red tape and internal debates, Stafford Beer has taken up another bold venture, Project Cyberfog. By broadcasting debates from the operations room and measuring public opinion, he's hoping to deepen democracy and truly revolutionize politics. It's something of a sibling to Project Cybersyn, much smaller in scope, but very big on ambition and vision. As, of course, is usually the case with Stafford Beer. His aim is to use the charmingly named Algedonic Mirror, a gadget designed by his son, to create a feedback loop, a loop between citizens and politicians, something which could transform politics as we know it. Everything will become interconnected, with citizens and politicians taking cues from each other and responding to feedback in real time. This will mark the beginning of a true participatory democracy in Chile, a cybernetic democracy.
The workforce knows that the president knows how they feel. And worse, the president knows that the workforce knows that he knows. And so you can go on indefinitely.
Stafford claims he has sold Allende on that idea, but other priorities intervene.
I've never found anybody else with the guts to try.
Stafford is also bringing cybernetics to the masses with a passion and enthusiasm that's truly infectious.
I got into very close friendship with a number of the leading Chilean singers, guitarists, songwriters, and I even wrote songs myself about cybernetics, would you believe?
He's even looking to Cuba. Yes, Cuba, for inspiration.
We wanted to use slogans because Chileans were very aware of the role that these had played in the Cuban government.
For this British management consultant, touting Cuba as a model is a very bold and provocative move. It's as if he's deliberately trying to provoke his peers at the esteemed Athenaeum Club. It's really not the kind of place that would host a book talk by Fidel Castro. By then, this father of eight, yes, we are talking about Stafford, has another thrilling Chilean adventure on his mind. And this adventure involves more than just sightseeing. His daughter Vanilla remembers him broaching this delicate subject.
One of the things we discussed was the possibility of him fathering a child in Chile. He was quite keen on the idea. He'd been invited to become a father there.
I can give you a list of my friends at that time that can ask for a baby for sure.
Gabriel Rodriguez confirms that in those days, Mapu's sexual revolution was in fact in full swing.
The Mapu was a network of people getting not married but sharing beds, let's say. And Fernando was part of that, and all my friends were part of that.
This political party, Mapu, does sound like a lot of fun. A mix of Marxists, hippies, and technocrats. As fate would have it, Stafford's grand entrance occurs just in time.
He was a fascinating guy for people in Chile, like us. Huh? Enormous beard and with the belt and he's talking and he's drinking. So probably he was involved on that. That's not probably, 100% sure. The question is, how many? And that's the clear question.
Stafford Beer's romantic pursuits are overshadowed by his efforts to defend himself against accusations of being a power-hungry technocrat.
Now, I have been very much blamed for doing this, and I resent the blame I've had very much. I've been told that I centralized power for Dr. Allende. This isn't the case at all.
Is it a classic case of misunderstanding? Stafford's critics might just fail to see that the centralizing features of cybersyn are largely due to the limitations in computer technology and the resources available. Is their vision of having a computer in every factory really feasible in this country that is starved of resources? Sure, it's very alluring and Stafford agrees, but it's just not feasible in a Chile that is struggling with crisis on so many fronts. As Stafford points out in an interview, and I quote, Chile just cannot afford to dole out a ration of computers, for its prior problem is to dole out a ration of milk. End of quote. Well, well put. As Stafford points out, there is really nothing deliberately autocratic or authoritarian about the setup.
These data were not used in an autocratic fashion at all. They all went to one computer because we only had one computer. And if you've only got one computer, then ipso facto, you're centralized. But we were not centralized in the political sense in which this has been taken up by some critics.
Besides, he readily concedes that it's the Chilean workers who are the ones with the most comprehensive knowledge of their factories, as well as the processes that are happening within them. That's why the cybersyn engineers go and interview them right before making those quantified flowcharts.
There is no one better qualified to model a plant than the man whose life is spent working in it. He knows. We have constructed a little tool in the quantified flowchart. And in handing this tool to the workers, we have no technocratic problems.
It may seem problematic that cybersyn experts lead the modeling activity in each enterprise. But this technique goes back to Stafford's days in the steel industry. Back then, he hired experts in disciplines such as anthropology, zoology, and even Kantian philosophy. And they would dissect the steelworks through techniques learned in those fields. So the idea of a socialist utopia somehow dedicating time and resources to teach its workers about Kant, or zoology for that matter, solely for the purposes of modeling a caramel factory sounds a little bit far-fetched. But even if that comes to be, what about, say, chemistry and physics? Shouldn't the emancipated workers trust at least some experts? The crux of the disagreement here is whether management cybernetics is pure science, as Stafford seems to believe, or pure class warfare, as his leftist critics argue. The truth, as always, lies somewhere in between. There is something about the British critique of CyberSyn that doesn't feel quite right. Is CyberSyn exclusively for managers, as its critics claim? In a sense, of course, yes, because Corpus Technocrats ultimately initiate and oversee it. But it's important to remember that in Allende's Chile, Corfu itself is being democratized, with unions even appointing members of its board. In principle, the workers can have a say in the redesign of the project, even if they played no role whatsoever in its conception. That, at least, is what the future holds. It's a classic chicken and egg scenario for Stafford and his opponents. Should you prioritize worker liberation first and then create a project like CyberSyn that caters to their specific needs and wants? Or do you start with a technocratic version of the project and only then gradually democratize it to meet the workers' real expectations? This debate, unfortunately, doesn't get settled. As the Chilean leftists debate some of these abstractions, the right-wing military is quietly plotting their next move. There are whispers of talks between the Chilean Navy and the Chicago Boys, focusing on the post-Allende economy and how to run it. The Navy needs a blueprint of some kind, and the Chicago Boys are happy to start working on one. And you can remain assured that it would be heavy on free markets and privatization. And the CIA, too, intensifies their effort. David Phillips, a veteran operative with a track record of success in Guatemala and Cuba and Brazil, has been tasked with weakening Allende. But with the stakes higher than ever, how far would he go to accomplish his mission? Phillips earned his reputation as a Cold War innovator and something of the CIA's own gossip czar in the run-up to regime change in Guatemala in 1954. We actually talked about it before on an earlier episode. Remember when Che Guevara, then just a humble doctor, found himself in Guatemala, observing its progressive government locked in a bitter struggle with the United Fruit Company? Well, eventually that firm mobilized its many friends in the CIA, and they trained a whole force of rebels that were keen to march on the capital. The numbers were relatively small, but this is where David Phillips came in. He leveraged the power of dark tech to make these rebels look like a real threat. Phillips employed a clever media strategy, radio transmissions, political songs, graffiti, and even disguised operatives who were distributing battery-powered radios throughout the country. And there was a very good reason to distribute all those radio sets. A covert radio station established by Phillips was disseminating what we now call fake news, duping the population into thinking that the opposition and this rebel force were actually much stronger and larger than they actually were. In fact, the president was eventually forced to step down, and the nation spiraled into a bloody civil war, a civil war that took hundreds of thousands of lives. And now it's very tempting for David Phillips, the mastermind behind it all, to try some of the same tricks on Allende's Chile. Guatemala, Cuba, Brazil. It's as if the CIA was mobilizing every trick it has learned in previous operations against the Chilean leader. How could Stafford's cybernetic software possibly protect Allende? And just weeks after taking office, Phillips does find himself facing a military coup in Santiago. The first sign of trouble comes one morning at the end of June, when a rogue officer leads a small but dangerous unit downtown. They do want to take on the government. The numbers alone are not enough to send a chill down anyone's spine. Not unlike in Guatemala. 6 tanks, 10 armored vehicles, and a group of just 80 soldiers. The fact that these soldiers are cooperating with Patria y Libertad adds a dangerous new element to the mix. Besides, who really knows how many mutinous units are there in the country? Allende calls on the workers to take over the factories and come to his defense. And some of them do answer the call. But sadly, it's not the mass mobilization he's been hoping for. The Chilean journalist Alfredo Sepulveda reflects on the events of that day.
But the coup is opposed by the commander-in-chief of the army, General Prats, and his second-in-command, General Augusto Pinochet. And you can see the pictures of June 29th, in which Pinochet, dressed in army suit, army combat suit, appears with the commander-in-chief in the army, suffocating this coup attempt. It's incredible.
The mutiny lasts a harrowing 4 hours, leaving a trail of death and destruction in its wake. 22 people lose their lives, and 50 more are wounded.
It is kind of a triumph for the government because everybody was fearing a coup, and the coup had happened in June, okay? And the coup had been quashed, and the government was still in charge of the country.
But even as Allende survives this onslaught, the victory feels bittersweet. For now, his enemies have seen how weak and few his supporters truly are. They have also seen what they are likely to do in the case of a coup. And who knows, they might actually use that knowledge to their advantage next time. There is a curious footnote to this coup, though. It might be that Americans were involved in helping the coup plotters, and now some people in Washington, most likely in the CIA, are busy trying to find ways to extract them. In desperation, they may have even turned to MI6, Britain's infamous secret service. Note the irony here. It's the kind of mission that the young Stafford Beer may have been asked to undertake himself, at least back in his military days. This brings us to a very interesting point that so far we have somewhat neglected in this podcast. From fighting for queen and country to advising a socialist president in Latin America, Stafford Beer has done it all. In fact, his unusual career path is a bit of a head-scratcher. The contrast is so stark that it begs for close examination. You already know the basics. Towards the end of the Second World War, Stafford is stationed in India.
I was making logical models of the problems in India, of the expected problems of the takeover in 1947 when the British Raj disappeared. I was one of the last people to leave India, as a matter of fact.
The notes from his officer training days in Bangalore offer a glimpse into the unique skills that he acquired during this time, from making explosives to using photography in order to survey enemy terrain. Stafford is stationed in India with the Gurkha Rifles. They're this military unit composed of soldiers and officers, mostly from today's India and Nepal. Its history stretches back to the days of the East India Company, the ITT of the day, if you will. And even after India and Nepal gained independence, some Gurkha soldiers chose to remain in the British Army. Loyalty to the crown runs deep in the veins of the soldiers, and Stafford shares many of their biases. Perhaps it's for this reason that he had this very ambivalent feelings even about someone like Gandhi. We have a tape of him reflecting upon those times. The sound quality is not ideal, I must warn you, not least because it's part of a conversation that's happening inside one of Stafford Beer's favorite pubs in Wales. So, bear with us.
I saw Gandhi twice, and at the time I thought that he was a regressive force.
Regressive force. That's what he calls Gandhi. Yes, Gandhi, the much-admired fighter for Indian independence and a keen practitioner of civil disobedience, a figure admired by many around the globe, and of course in Latin America. But as Stafford returns from India, something shifts within him. His enthusiasm for the empire has waned. So when the Suez Canal crisis hits in 1956, he is dead against lending his expertise to defend British interests.
at the time of Suez. Because I was listed. See, I'd been in the Gurkhas, so I was a crack infantry officer. I'd been a staff captain in intelligence, therefore I was listed as an intelligence waller. And I'd been in the Department of Psychology and could have been regarded as a brainwashing type.
So, just to make sure that you caught what Stafford was saying in that pop conversation, his army job was in intelligence, and he feared that during the Suez Crisis, he would be called to work as a brainwashing type, helping to spread propaganda to defend the British Empire. He may have done it a decade ago, but not anymore. Stafford's attempts to explain his beliefs to his conservative father fall on deaf ears. The old man wants to hear none of it. For Stafford, it seems to be a traumatic experience, which might explain his later rebellion against the British elites, of which, of course, his father was definitely a member.
I said to him, I wish you to know I'll go to jail. I'm not going to do this. And he was appalled, and we never recovered our relationship.
Thus, as soon as that invitation from Chile, from Fernando Flores and Corfo, lands on his desk, it probably feels like the final opportunity for redemption, a chance to make amends for the wrongs carried in the name of the British Empire. So it's not that surprising that Stafford actually jumps at it. Now, Stafford may not have been a fan of Indian independence or its leaders, but he did admire the country's rich spiritual heritage.
My professors of philosophy had told me that Eastern religion, they didn't know about it. I immediately, as soon as I got to India, apprenticed myself to a guru. And this was before the Beatles, you know. I mean, it wasn't the in thing to do. And I started learning about Vedantic philosophy, and I started studying yoga as from 1946.
It wasn't until he arrived in Chile that Stafford's spiritual side started coming out of hiding. Late at night, he would leave his luxurious Sheraton suite to meditate at a nearby ashram.
When he was in India, I saw some pictures he showed me. He looked like a real Indian Hindu.
Sonia Mardosevich is a rare woman in the male-dominated world of Cybersyn. She speaks very good English, and she's been serving as something of Stafford's assistant on many of these trips. But her English is not the only thing that makes her stand out. As a member of Chile's spiritual counterculture, Sonia introduces Stafford to a host of fascinating characters.
I don't think one can understand Stafford Beer without that experience. I'm sure of that. He's a cybernetic, but he is also an Indian. I couldn't have understood him if I didn't have these two ways of approaching life.
Stafford's Chilean jaunts are always short and sweet. A week, perhaps 10 days. But this time, Stafford is throwing caution to the wind and committing to a six-week adventure. That's right, six whole weeks. And to add to the intrigue, he won't be lounging in his usual Sheraton.